You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a, well, wonderful spring day.
It is.
I'm not going to say sunny because it's not sunny where I am.
It's a little high overcast right now. It's going to be sunny today. We're recording this broadcast on Wednesday, March 13, 2024, for broadcast on March 14, 2024. And right now it's sunny. And then it's going to be sunny and breezy. And the high today is going to be 63 degrees. And the high of the day of the broadcast will be 67 degrees. The notable weather event coming up, which will already be occurring by the time this broadcast, is a wind advisory from the National Weather Service. We're going to have one of our 2 to 3 day north wind events here in the Sacramento Valley. Southern California listeners, you all have, we had the Santa Ana winds down there. You may be having one as we speak, because this is the same kind of thing in Northern California. Dry wind coming off the land, not the sea. And it's going to be gusty winds up to 34 miles an hour Wednesday night, up to 41 miles an hour during the day on Thursday. North wind, 23 to 29 miles an hour average. Thursday night, continuing 20 to 24 miles an hour, gusts to 34. Friday, tapering off, but still 18 to 22 miles an hour with gusts as high as 32. And the notable thing about these winds, just as with the Southern California Santa Ana winds, is the very low humidity. When this occurs, things dry out very, very rapidly. The soil has plenty of moisture. Don't worry about your trees, your shrubs, your deeper rooted flowers, or even your turf at this point. There's lots of moisture still in the soil, but your container plants are going to dry out. We're going to go back to our water everything every day status at the nursery, and you need to keep an eye on, poke your finger into the soil of those container plants that you have out there, because they can dry out very, very rapidly. That will clear out Friday night. It'll be about 44 degrees on Friday night, temperatures in the low to mid 40s at nighttime for the next several days. However, this will be fun. Friday, 72. Saturday, 71. Oh. Sunday, 72. Monday, 74. And Tuesday, 72 degrees. So every garden.
Does that mean we're in summer, Don? Has spring ended?
No, this is spring, and every garden center and every hardware store in Northern California is going to have all kinds of vegetable plants. And this is one of those weird times. It's warmer than average. The nights are also warmer than average. You grab those tomato plants, you stick them in the ground, they'll probably just sit there and sulk, but they won't be badly harmed at this point if it stays this warm, but it won't. So, you know, you're going to have great selection out there as you go around all the places you like to buy plants, and hopefully they'll mention to you, maybe go ahead and shelter these for a few more days, a couple more weeks until we see what the weather is going to do. No, I do not think it is time to put these things in the ground, but if you're going to triage your weekend projects, and you're buying some vegetables to get in the ground as soon as possible, the least injury would occur to your tomato plants. The greatest injury would occur to your pepper and egg plants. And beans, great time to plant green beans. Beans like to go in when it's a little cooler and get their growth and their production going. You can prep your beds. You can get some nice compost and spread it on the surface and sprinkle it down, maybe after the wind, so it doesn't all blow away. And you don't have to turn it in, just spread it on the surface and water it. Let it just sit there and it'll immediately start sort of incorporating itself. You can do all that stuff. There's some things you can plant. Kitchen herbs can go in right now. You can still plant some of those leafy greens or the things like beets where you're growing them both for the greens and to later eat the beet itself. There's things you can do and plant. But let's not make this sudden burst of temperatures in the low 70s cause you all to rush out and plant your whole vegetable garden. Get ready, do it over time. Go back into those nurseries and those hardware stores in a few weeks when they'll have nice, healthy plants, and you'll be able to put them right in the ground when the soil temperature is where it needs to be.
Well, you know, Don, it's to go out and weed.
That would be a
weeding
great
would be wonderful.
Yeah, and this is the thing with dry weather coming up, but if you just do a little soaking beforehand, most of those grasses, this is something that people often don't realize, grasses that we're dealing with here came up in the fall and the winter, and they grew through the winter. They're getting ready to go into their flowering stage. Grasses, when they go into their flowering stage, their roots begin to die back very rapidly. So that oat or barley or rye that you couldn't pull out of the ground a month ago will pop right out now. And you can just pull it up and drop it. It'll just wither away and compost on site, or pile it up if you're a tidy sort of person. You don't need to haul it away. It makes great biomass, great organic amendment to the soil. In fact, one of my very favorite mulches is grass straw, which I create simply by taking a weed eater, chopping down the oats and the barley and things like that, letting them lie for a few days, and then just lifting them up and spreading them around newly transplanted seedlings. So you can start creating your own straw mulch also. Mid-March is when my son and I have traditionally taken our very large tarp and spread it out over the grassy weeds that have grown in an area where we plan to plant about 5 to 6 weeks later, anchor it down securely for wind events. We have things to do that with, and just leave it there. Put it on there right as we go into, or perhaps right after that wind episode, so you aren't having to wrestle the thing, and leave it on there for 4 to 6 weeks. And when you pull that back, all those grasses will have almost magically melted away and begun to compost on site. It's one of the most effective herbicides you can buy, a tarp. Okay, spread it out over the moist weeds. There's moisture in the soil. Anchor it down securely, 4 to 6 weeks for annual weeds. That's pretty much all it takes to kill them down adequately for you to just mow them down, or just rake them out of the way, plant in between them, makes an excellent mulch. So good time now to get going on your summer vegetable garden, everything except literally putting things in the ground.
You know, Don, I do have a question about that tarp thing that you're talking about. I have a bunch of weeds that are growing underneath a plum tree. Mm-hmm. Now, if I were to tarp the ground, would that harm the roots of the plum tree?
For 4 to 6 weeks? No. That's the thing. Okay. We know that long-term application of things like landscape fabric affects soil and affects water and air movement, although, you know, it still happens. But a tarp temporarily put on just to kill down the weeds, it does not do any harm. So it's a very simple thing you can do, actually, to help deal with those weeds that are growing at the base of the tree.
We have a couple of things that we were going to show as a fundraiser. How'd it go?
It was sold out.
How did that movie sold go?
Out. They actually had to turn people away. So thank you, everyone who turned out for this great movie screening that was a benefit for KDRT. It was a huge success. And as I say, standing room only, because they don't allow that. So the place was full. And those were all people who paid for tickets, and unfortunately even had to turn a few people away. So again, wonderful fundraiser for KDRT. Thanks to the local producers of that movie. And thanks to all of you who turned out for it. And especially thanks to the volunteers from KDRT and Davis Media Access who were there processing all those people as they came for the show.
Processing people?
Opening the door and letting them in.
I thought they were greeting and taking money.
That too. So KDRT is community radio. We rely on contributions from folks like you and also fundraisers like that to cover our operating costs. If you like what you hear, if you like the Davis Garden Show or all the other great programming here at KDRT, you can always head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button.
And we always talk about a show, one of our shows, one of our compatriots. Well, today I want to talk about me. I do a show called That's Life, in addition to this show that I do with Don. And due to health issues, I hadn't done anything yet this year. I think we've been playing replays of old shows. Well, I'm getting back in the swing of things. Look for new shows starting about April. And actually, Don will be one of our first, because he and I are going to do what's our topic for the show, Don?
We're probably going to talk about jazz.
Jazz.
I do a show on jazz. So we're gonna explain to you why you should listen to jazz. How's that?
Okay. All right. Well, enough of that. Let's get on to our questions.
Okay.
So today, Melissa writes to us, greetings from Glendale, California. My question is about an apple espalier we have. Now, just in case the listeners don't know, espalier just means you prune it so it's flat against a wall or a fence or a trellis, something.
Well, I want to say something real quick, because people ask me how to pronounce that. And I think the pronunciation you gave was very appropriate. Espalier, espalier, espalier. I've heard them all. They're all fine. It is a French term, so espalier was probably correct. But what she's referring to is, as Lois says, training it flat. In the case of apples and pears, literally tying them to a structure or a support so that they have a particular frame. It can be as simple, though, as just pruning something more or less two-dimensionally. People get kind of caught up on, how do you espalier a pomegranate? We have a listener who has done that. I have a beautiful picture of his pomegranate espaliered, and he's done three of them, I believe, at this point. It's a lot of work in the case of a twiggy, stiff, and mildly thorny plant like a pomegranate, but it's just a matter of essentially making great use of a limited space by making a plant that would ordinarily be a tree more or less two-dimensional, like a hedge, but in some cases like a very formally trained thing. So you go online to look it up, you get a little overwhelmed, oh, I have to do all this, I have to do all that. No, it's just kind of put the plant in and prune out the branches that come in the direction you don't want them. So it's a training thing, but it is particularly adapted or used for apples and pears, primarily because, one, they're very limber branches when they're young, so it's easy to tie them in place, and they fruit on spurs. Spurs meaning little short shoots that develop along, let's say, three-year-old wood that fruit year after year after year in the same place. It's harder to espalier a peach or a nectarine or something like that because they only fruit on last year's growth. These fruit in the same location. So once you have the basic framework and those spurs are there, you know roughly how much fruit you're going to get and you know where it's going to occur.
Well, let's get back to the question. She's talking about this apple tree. She said it's a Frankenstein 5-in-1 tree. That is 5 varieties grafted into one tree. Yeah. It was an impulse buy 10 years ago. In hindsight, I should have picked a single variety that would produce more in our sunny Southern California zone, but I adore how it looks. And last year, it produced more than it ever has. I understand apples are produced on spurs. My question is, can I cut a new branch to spur length to get more apples? Any tips on how to increase production? Thank you, and I'm grateful for your show. I always learn so much. I want to answer this one, Don. Okay. The answer is no.
Probably. The answer is probably no.
So spurs are produced by the plant intentionally. In other words, the thing that grows into a spur wouldn't have grown into a new branch. It would just be a spur because that's what it's supposed to be. So if you take a branch and cut it, well, there might have been a spur bud in there, but I don't think so.
When you cut a branch back, what's likeliest to happen is right at the point where you cut it to a very vigorous shoot will come out. And so the opposite of a spur will happen. You'll get vigorous growth at that point. Now, I could be wrong. I've never espaliered hundreds of apples. So any listeners, from the United Kingdom or the Pacific Northwest, where this kind of thing is done very regularly, set me straight on this. But my belief is that if you cut that back to leave a little stub, which would look sort of like a spur, it'll just resprout out even more vigorously from the point where you cut it. So the spurs occur naturally, as Lois is saying. It's, I don't know whether it's intentional because that's sort of anthropomorphizing the apple and its thinking processes, but it does occur spontaneously, naturally on about three-year-old wood. And I don't think there's any way to encourage more of them except to prune less in some ways. So I don't think it'll do what you're after, but I think that they will produce more spurs over time. The problem, this is not the question that was asked, but the problem with a 5-in-1 apple, particularly in Southern California, is that apples especially tend to have high chilling hour requirements. And the varieties they choose for these multi-graft trees, they're choosing them for a national market, not Glendale, not San Diego, not Los Angeles. You need apples that will produce with a couple hundred chilling hours. And that's a fairly short list of apples. Most apples are several hundred. A lot of apples are over 1,000. There's a lot of apples we can't even grow in Northern California and get good results because they simply, the flowers don't develop because we don't get enough chilling hours. I have several of those on my farm that I planted for other reasons, mainly because I got them free. So I wouldn't be surprised of the 5 varieties on your tree if only one or two of them actually fruit well for you ever, which is fine if you like the look of the espaliered apple. But as you have observed, and just for other listeners, in milder winter climates, you do need to find the varieties that will flower and fruit well with your local chilling hours. And my parents in San Diego, all right, north coast of San Diego, right near UCSD, if you all know where that is, averaged 50 to 100 chilling hours in a typical winter. 100 would be a really good year. My father, for reasons best known to him, a stubborn man, kept wanting to plant apricots and peaches and things like that. And he'd go down to wherever the garden center was and buy them that were intended for the interior of San Diego County and plant them and never get fruit. The flower simply wouldn't develop properly. He did discover one apple called Beverly Hills that produced very well. We had it in our yard there, 50 chilling hours, fine with Beverly Hills apple. It would produce dozens, if not hundreds, of fruit. I would describe them as fairly mediocre as apples go, but my mom loved them. She could make her own applesauce and all that kind of thing. By the way, she had very little trouble with codling moth. All of us get problems with worms in our apples. She had practically none. Why? She probably had the only apple in the neighborhood, and it did produce well, and it was okay. So you need to look locally, check the tag for the chilling hours. You need something that only needs 100 or 200 chilling hours in most parts of Southern California. Interior, maybe 300 to 400. So yeah, for other listeners looking for apples in mild winter climates, they do exist. There are varieties that are out there that you can do, but typically those multi-graft ones are going to include Red Delicious or Golden Delicious or something like that that just needs way more chilling than you get.
So if I got a 5-in-1 apple, if I was in her situation, mm-hmm. and only two of the varieties were producing, I'd be real tempted to just prune back or prune out the varieties that were not producing. Of course, how would I know that? Well, I would take five colors of yarn and I would put it around the stem so I'd know this one made fruit, this one didn't make fruit. And then when I go to prune the next year, I can decide, well, maybe I don't really need a branch right there.
Yeah. I mean, you could do some retraining for the one or two that are producing. Well, I've got to say, Dave Wilson Nursery is one of the major producers of these. They put tags on there that last for years. In fact, I've had problems. Their tags are so sturdy, I've had them girdle branches. So I make a practice of going and loosening them and moving them to smaller branches. So there's probably fully labeled. You could jot down the varieties, send us a note as to which ones they are, because I'd actually be kind of curious as to which ones they've chosen. And we could talk about which ones are likelier to become permanent. But if you like the way it looks, I mean, look, I have an apple hedge. The apple hedge that I have was created, I think I've told this story before. I received a bundle of varieties, five varieties, two of each, with no tags. It was an assortment pack that the company made, and they came with no tags. And so I contacted them and said, we don't really have a use for these because they have no tags. And they said, well, you know what? We don't really have a use for them either if they have no tags, so do whatever you want. So we brought them home and we planted a hedge. We planted these apples about 4 feet apart in a long curved hedge, 10 of them. One failed. I planted two more of something else. So I have an 11 tree hedge of apples. Six of them have never fruited. In all these years, they were apparently gourmet apples, you know, some really interesting varieties that probably need 1200 to 1500 chilling hours. And two of them went along for 20 years and then abruptly fruited a couple of years ago. I mean, fruited so heavily, the branches were hanging. I had sackloads of apples from whatever this or gourmet or heirloom variety was. It ripened in October, November, very late. It's stored great. It's produced a pretty good crop ever since, but for some reason, it just decided to wait 20 years to start fruiting. I get plenty of chilling hours out here by comparison with folks in town. In fact, I was just looking at the data for this year. We've had, what was the number?
850 chilling hours in Dixon.
And only
709 in Davis.
And that's a fairly typical difference. Those of us out in the country do get more chilling hours, but apparently I reached a threshold for this one variety. Four of the other trees have never fruited, and I'm guessing if they haven't by now, they probably never will. But you know what? I like the apple hedge. It looks great. The wildlife likes it. It's a perfect hedge for where it is. So if you just think of these, this is an ornamental that happens to produce nice fruit now and then. If you like the look of the espalier and only two branches are producing fruit, when that's okay with you, that's great. Just go ahead and leave it as is.
You said that four of them have never produced fruit. Right. Now, if they don't get enough chilling hours, do they even blossom?
No. And this is the thing.
No blossoms.
Yeah, the impact of low chilling hours, this is the thing that I've realized people don't really understand. It affects the development of the flower. And so as an example, the Harcot apricot, which we sold a lot of in the 1980s and 90s. Why? Because it was brown rot resistant. Well, it stopped fruiting. And it hadn't been fruiting that great before, but it completely stopped. I have one that's been in the ground for 20 years, and it fruited at first, and it stopped fruiting. Apparently, it needs more chilling hours than we're getting these days. But one year, a few years back, it looked like it was going to give what we in the business call popcorn bloom. There were so many flower buds, I thought, all right, I'm going to walk out here, and this is going to be in full bloom, and this will be the year we see what goes on. Those flowers, I went up. I wish I'd taken pictures of it. The flower buds were tight. And then they started to open, and they tried to open, and they just fell off. They don't open, mm-hmm. they don't pollinate. And it's a more of a spectrum than an absolute condition. So in some places they open, but they don't pollinate. The pollen tubes can't develop. In some places they open, they pollinate, but the fruit doesn't develop that well. And in some areas, parts of Texas where peaches are grown, for example, when they run into chilling hours problems, it affects the ripening duration of the fruit. They have to keep going through the orchards more than once to pick, and the quality of the fruit is affected. But the main effect of low chilling hours is that the flower doesn't develop properly. So you'll see buds, and then you'll go out there and they're just gone, or they haven't opened properly. So that's what low chilling hours typically means. A couple of these, I've never even seen them set flower buds. So they're lovely ornamental things that happen to be apples. I also have one, and those of you looking for early flowering and really good producing apple and relatively low chill requirements, the Anna apple, Anna, A-N-N-A, mine has been in full bloom for 2 weeks. It wow. starts blooming every year at the end of the almond blossoming. And it's ahead of even the peaches and plums, way ahead of the other apples, which in our area, just in case you're listening outside of the area, in our area, apples typically blossom in April. This one starts blooming in late February. It's obviously self-fruitful since no other apple is blooming when it is, and it sets tons of fruit, and it's very good quality fruit. So if you're looking, you know, there's a bunch of lower chill apples, and it depends on where you are as to which ones you want to look into. Anna has proven to be a very good one. It's part of this hedge, and it, you know, I go out and I take pictures of it every year because why is this apple tree blooming in February? Well, that's what that particular one does.
Well, let's go back to getting messages from our listeners. And by the way, Don, if someone wants to send in a question, where do they send it?
They send it to davisgardenshow@gmail.com.
Nigel writes, my mulberry tree recently dropped two large limbs and was found to be rotten all the way through with what looks like a fungus. Some pictures are below. The fungus was quite advanced. I suspect the years of pollarding left this tree susceptible, and the insides of some of the limbs seemed filled with brown sawdust. Ooh. I've now cut down most of the tree and plan to hire someone to chop it up. Normally, I'd like to spread the wood chips around the yard. And while I don't have any other mulberries, I'm a bit worried dropping this much fungus around, which might infect some other species. He uses the wood chips on peaches, plums, and a pear. Should I have the tree service cart away the chippings, or would it be okay to use them in my yard?
It is absolutely okay to use them in your yard. The fungus that you're seeing there is just, they're saprophytic. They're simply decaying cellulose, decaying the wood that's on the interior of the tree. Probably not the cause of the problem. It's possible that something else caused it. You can see trees that are completely hollow and mm-hmm. standing just fine. The inside of a tree is just wood, and wood sometimes rots. That is not a pathogen that you need to be worried about elsewhere in the yard. So good news. There may be places you're listening. Let me think if there's any place where you would have an issue with the sudden oak death. If you're in Sunset Zone 17 and you're taking down something that's a host to sudden oak death, I can't remember if mulberries are. I don't think so. But in that zone, the fog belt of Northern California, you might want to look up sudden oak death and read about the protocol for dealing with disposal of those kinds of things. I don't think that's relevant here. And my guess is, in fact, not my guess, I'm quite comfortable with the idea that you could just chip that all up and spread it out and let it continue doing its job. These are the organisms that decay wood, help create soil. So it's fine to spread them out. No, there's no particular risk of infecting your other trees.
And James writes, I have a question about my chaparral currants. That's Ribes malvaceum. I lost one last year, and a second one seems to be succumbing to the same affliction. About half of the plant flowered and leafed out normally, but the other half, and all of the one that died, never leafed out, but produced little clusters of flower buds that then withered in place without flowering. He sends photos. There may have been some lesions or bleedings near the base of the plant, but it's hard for me to tell. What disease is this likely to be? What can I do about it? And failing that, how can I prevent it next time? For context, this is on a north-facing slope in Sunset Zone 16 in somewhat clay-like chert-derived soil. Also, do you think I might have better luck with Ribes sanguineum?
That looks like... great pictures, by the way. It looks like pretty classic Phytophthora to me. Now, there are other pathogens that can cause a similar problem that will kill one branch or one part of a branch. What I tell people to look for, if you're curious, although it doesn't probably make much difference in terms of management, if it appears to be progressing up, like one whole side of the plant from the ground up, then it's probably Phytophthora cinnamomai. Phytophthora cinnamomai, what we call crown and root rot. If it's progressing up from the soil, from the point of contact of the base of the plant with the soil, and then everything above that point dying. If it is one branch up higher, suddenly dead, but everything below that, fine. That's not Phytophthora cinnamomai. That's an airborne disease like Cercospora or Botrytis firea or something like that. One of those types of things. I had half of a redbud die last year. Half of a Western redbud. It's a lovely plant. I planted it 7 or 8 years ago. It's about 7 feet tall. It grows and blooms beautifully. And very abruptly, one side of the plant from the ground up died completely. All I did in that instance was cut that portion out, pull the soil and stuff away that was around the base just to get more air exchange right near the base of the plant. Rest of it looks fine. So far, so good. But that's the way Phytophthora tends to work, unfortunately. And it then can, if conditions favor continued infection, which is high temperature and high moisture, back to that in a moment, it'll progress into the rest of the plant. So you want to reduce the conditions, change the irrigation pattern is one of the most common answers. And if you do have to replant, elevate so that water, if you're using drip or whatever during the high temperature periods of the year, always drains away from the crown of the plant.
So the plants that you've chosen, your Ribes malvaceum and Ribes sanguineum, are both wonderful Ribes. And I think either of them would do well for you as long as Don says, you plant it up. These guys do not like wet feet.
While they're drought tolerant, most home gardeners don't want what happens if they go completely dry, which is
they estivate.
Yes, they go. That's your vocabulary word for the week. Estivation, summer dormancy, which is not very attractive. There are a number of our California natives that do that. Huh. But in the case of Ribes, as an example, if you irrigate it, it looks good during the summer. If you don't, it just starts dropping leaves and can go completely dormant.
It's perfectly healthy.
Yeah, that's perfectly normal. There's a lot of our Carpinteria californica, the bush anemone. People ask me for it every so often when they see it in bloom in April and May. And I said, be aware that this plant looks really, really rough in the summer. It just looks great in the spring. Ribes can look good through the summer if you keep them irrigated. This is a case where drip irrigation can be a big part of the problem. In my opinion, and the opinion of folks like the late owner of Las Politas Nursery, drip and natives are not a good combination at all. As he would say, the only plants that are good on drip irrigation are the kind of riparian plants that would normally have water trickling at their base, like willows and things like that. Woody plants like Ribes, they're fine with moisture, but it needs to be a little further away from the stem. And honestly, I'd rather have you just sprinkling or flooding that whole zone every 7 to 10 days than running drip irrigation more often than that. That will depend on your soil as to how often and how long is appropriate. But several days of surface drying between waterings is very likely to block any further infection by Phytophthora. Whereas drip irrigation running close to the base of the plant more frequently, especially if protected in mulch that's up, get crowded up against the stem, as far as we can tell, that could be a problem as well, just trapping moisture there. These are plants typically that wouldn't experience high moisture at the time of high temperatures. That's not a common combination in California. So if you have to irrigate it to keep it looking good, it's better to do it less frequently and deeper and further away from the crown of the plant. I happen to think that flooding them or sprinklers are really a better approach. I know that sounds weird, better approach than drip, partly because drip is so typically installed and run in a manner where it comes on frequently, sort of the daily or every couple of days replacement of what the plant has used, as if it were a crop. Now, if you're using drip, and I do, I have thousands of feet of drip on my farm, I run it for a couple to several hours, depending on what I'm watering, and I'll get a good deep watering. I'm aiming for 18 to 24 inch depth of irrigation, and then I'll go as long as I can between waterings without stressing the plant, which on my soil is 7 to 10 days. Sandier soils. I remember gardening in coastal San Diego with basically a foot of sandy soil. I had to water every couple of days, but you should allow the surface to dry off a bit if you possibly can. So if you have drip, just pull it away from the crown if necessary. That would probably help.
I noticed from your picture, either it has rained recently or he's using the sprinkler because nearby plants have little drops of water on them.
Yeah,
But you can't see the bottom of that plant in your picture because there's all this other green stuff around it. And I don't know if it's just me, but all the times that I have seen successful ribes, they have not had companions within, 6 inches of the plant. So I would suggest maybe getting rid of a few of the little green things around there.
Yeah, I would clear that all out. Now I'm zooming in on it. One of those is a California poppy, so he's going to be reluctant to take that out. But I would.
And that would be fine. It's light enough. It's fluffy enough. It's not.
I don't know. They make a massive foliage on my property. To me, a California poppy there falling over onto the crown of that plant would trap moisture in a way that I wouldn't find desirable. I would suggest pulling let's make a 3-foot area clear of vegetation. Everything else is fine, but just clear all that out of there. Try to get better air circulation in there. Even pull the soil away a little bit. I know you're going to be exposing some roots, but that's actually okay in this instance because you're concerned about continued infection. And then, as I say, however you're irrigating, if it is drip, let's just get that away from the crown. So a little further. Sometimes it's just a matter, honestly, of tugging the drip tubing another 6 inches away. That's really all it takes. Bearing in mind, you're not going to stress the plant by doing that because if you run it long enough, capillary action, which is our friend in irrigation, will spread the moisture to the roots as it needs to, but we'll be keeping it away from the crown. I have seen plants recover from Phytophthora. I've seen really important plants recover from Phytophthora simply by changing the irrigation pattern and opening up the area right around the crown. The example I give very frequently is the cork oaks on the quad at UC Davis, which date back to the late 1940s. And when I was a student in plant pathology, they were a classic example for showing us Phytophthora because that big corky bark shows the staining beautifully. And it was progressing up the trunks of most of them. And then they took out all the turf that was around the trees, put in turf block so that the thousands of students walking back and forth, the compaction from their traffic would be mitigated, moved all the irrigation so that it was pointing towards the lawn, away from the trees, and they all recovered. So you can save a tree or a plant that has Phytophthora by reducing the presence of moisture around the crown of the plant during high temperature periods.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so here is a message from a longtime listener and frequent writer, Ashdale.
Yep.
So Don and Lois, notice it's Don and Lois, yeah. You can cut that part out, Don.
That's all right.
What Prunus species would you suggest planting if I want continuous blooms from late autumn or early winter through early summer? I know that Prunus mume is first, followed by almond, okame cherry, fruiting apricots, the various plums, flowering and fruiting peaches, and then the rest of the flowering cherries. But if I want to stretch the blooms as early and as late as possible, how would I do that? I'm sort of in an exploration streak of the entire Prunus genus.
I see that. And I think you answered the question pretty well there. You want to run through that list real quick one more time?
Prunus mume.
Yep.
Almond.
Yep.
Okame cherry.
Yep.
Fruiting apricots. The various plums. Flowering and fruiting peaches, and then the rest of the flowering cherries.
Well, the late season will be a bit more challenging, but there are some, Prunus mume is the flowering apricot, which I always get a question when they come into bloom in this area, because they can bloom as early as January. And it's not an apricot like you're thinking of. People do use the fruit. It's dried and salted, and it's used for that purpose. But it also blooms very early, and there's a showy flowering cultivar of it that's out there as well. The one thing that was missing from that list, I would say, in terms of early bloom, is the Taiwan cherry, Prunus campanulata, when someone first brought one into us years ago to try and identify it, it really stumped us because it has this hanging tubular, campanulate flower shaped like a bell flower. Campanula being bell flower, many people know the ground cover. Well, this was it's a vivid reddish pink. I would almost call it red. Clusters of flowers, like every flowering cherry, fairly small tree, very well-mannered tree. My comment in my own description of this is stunning magenta red bell-shaped flowers are very early in late winter. Bronze fall color, tiny fruit attracts birds, not messy. Tree gets about 20 feet wide and tall. So like the other flowering cherries, can easily be trained lower. I'll come back to that in a moment. Paint the trunk with interior white latex paint when young to prevent sunburn. And like all the flowering cherries, needs excellent drainage. I do want to say, and this is for Ashdale, but others as well, many of these flowering trees, the flowering cherries, the flowering plums, if you do nothing except train them with a central leader, they'll get to be pretty big and you'll want to prune them like a normal tree for a structure. You can, in the case of flowering relatives of fruiting trees, I know you didn't ask this question, but I'm going to answer it anyway, use the modified central leader training technique, which about 2 years ago, you asked us to describe, and I promise one of these days we'll get around to that. What that really means...
Describe it so many times, Doug.
What it really means is you do take the center of the tree out at some point. Let's say you've let it grow for a year or two. It's 8-10 feet tall. Rather than letting it get taller and taller for one reason or another, maybe you have several trees and you want to have them at different levels in your landscape. You can take the central leader out to an existing lateral, carefully select the other branches down the stem so they radiate away from each other and are placed at least 6 to 12 inches apart up and down the stem, and have those become the permanent scaffold branches, but you've decided to control the height of the tree. You can do that with flowering relatives of fruiting trees. Modified central leader training technique can work very well for this. So you can control the height. To some extent, you can control the spread, but bear in mind as you choose these trees for whatever landscape this is that you're planning for, some of them are very stiff and upright and formal. Some of them are more outward, and this one is a more outward habit. Some of them are pronouncedly weeping, like the weeping cherries, which are spectacular, but need to be placed where they have room to develop. Some of those get as much as 20 feet across and require very careful training. So the growth habits can be an important part of your choice, as you don't just cram these into a yard because they're pretty and flower at a particular time of year. I know you wouldn't do that, but others might. Put them where they can each be a feature at its particular time. And if you want more information about the growth habit, Frank Schmidt Company, one of the big producers of these trees that sells them to wholesalers who grow them for retailers, has an outstanding website that shows the silhouette of each tree. So it shows, you know, your crab apples. You have crab apples that are stiff and upright and crab apples that are mounding and so forth. Same thing with the flowering cherries. Same thing with a lot of these other members of Prunus. So you would probably do best as you're doing your design and layout to keep in mind that those differing growth habits as well as the different seasons of bloom. So just to add to your list there, I'm sure we'll think of others, but a good starting point, the Taiwan cherry, Prunus campanulata.
When you're talking about the blossoms coming at different times, and I'm assuming that they're not going to last that long. I know Correct. My tree, it's 2 to 3 weeks that there's still some flowers on it. Yeah. So when you're planting them and planning them, if you plant the one, something that's going to be blooming now, and then next to it on either side, have something that's going to be blooming at such a far different time that they'll just be green. So that you're isolating and focusing on one tree at a time, or two trees or whatever. But
yeah, they tend to be a 7 to 10 day bloom. It's spectacular. This is why cherry blossom season is such a big deal in Washington, D.C., around the Tidal Basin or the Brooklyn Botanical Garden. My daughter lives out there, and you know, they track this is the week they'll be at their peak kind of thing. It's all right on their website as to when it is, because it varies a little bit from year to year. And as you say, there's some things that'll be, well, this Prunus campanulata, someone brought me a sample 2 weeks ago. So we're talking about early to mid-February. That's very early. They're blooming with the almonds. Prunus bleriana, which I'm sure Ashdale is familiar with, the so-called flowering plum, blooms with the almond. So that's very, very early. By the way, if you're intrigued by that group, don't forget that there is a dwarf Prunus, a Prunus glandulosa, which is a shrub. It's called the flowering almond, Prunus glandulosa rosa plena. Grows about, I don't know, 5 feet by 5 feet, blooms very, very early, soft pink flowers. Not that easy to find, but there are wholesalers that grow it. I had a couple of them in, which sold right away, needless to say. Gives you the look of a little almond tree on a shrub. So there's another member of Prunus you can look at. As you get sidetracked, and since he's like me, I know he will, Prunus cistina is another shrubby Prunus. That's a red leaf plum, but it's not a red leaf plum tree. It barely fruits, if at all. It's got a pretty little pink flower, and the berries that do come on are eaten by the birds. I've never seen it make a nuisance. Growers train it as a tree, but it's one that's more of a shrub. And if you want a small red leaf plum and you don't want to deal with all that fruit, Purple Pony, introduced into the market in 1962 and has never been known to fruit. It's a red leaf plum with the really pretty flowers they have and that real beautiful burgundy foliage. It's about a 12-foot small plum. And again, you don't have the litter factor from that one. So that would be one that would just crowd in with the major bloom period of the genus Prunus, which is in the month of March for us and into April. And of course, the last flowering cherry in our area is the pink flowered one, which is, I'll think of its name in a moment. We'll come back to that. Here we go. Kwanzan, which is the last of the bloomers for here. Big, fluffy cotton candy flowers of the very last, often blooming as late as early April. There are members of the genus that are important natives and important evergreen shrubs and important non-evergreen shrubs. So as you go through Prunus, you'll come across the Portuguese laurel, which is a shrub that has pretty long trailing white flowers, or trailing inflorescences, I should say. Slow growing background shrub, blooms a little later in the season. That's a tough plant, does very, very well here. If you're looking for a native screen, the Catalina cherry, Prunus illicifolia, there's some real confusion on the naming of and the inadvertent hybridization between Prunus illicifolia, Prunus lyonii. They're considered to be subspecies of each other. Great for a background hedge. The flowers are pretty but not showy. The fruit can be a nuisance in the sense of them receding, but birds love them. And so if you're looking for a shrub that would fill in as a backcrop to these and you're still focusing on the genus Prunus, look for some of those as well. Bearing in mind, those of you listening elsewhere thinking, oh, a native shrub, a lot of fruit. I mean, I do want people who plant the Catalina cherry or the holly leaf cherry to realize that you're likely to have this reseeding, not quite at the level of privets, but close. Well, as I browse through my database of members of the genus Prunus, if I think of any more, we'll certainly bring them to your attention. The difficult part will be getting late season color. There aren't anything in the genus I can think of that bloom midsummer or fall off the top of my head, but some of them, some of the cherries and others, have really nice fall color. So we can talk more about that.
And you can take your stone fruit, your Prunus, and just sort of expand it a little bit more to have other flowering things.
Well, there's the flowering relatives that I know he's aware of, but some of the listeners, and we've talked about these, the Red Baron peach is spectacular. It's just about to come into its amazing spring bloom. And there's another one called Saturn, which is a low chill peach. Red Baron and Saturn are both as little as 250 chilling hours. So listeners in Southern California, coastal areas, you plant that one, make it a focal point. When it's in bloom, they are both quite spectacular and they have very good fruit. One of my favorite of the ornamental versions of fruiting trees is the weeping Santa Rosa plum, which has an arching, it's just a naturally occurring spontaneous mutation that was propagated and is reasonably stable. Sometimes it tries to revert to upright. You can catch that pretty quickly. Typically what you get is a tree that's a plum that looks like a weeping willow. I mean, that's beautiful. And it's a very heavy producer. It's done very well for me. And it's one that I like to sell as a sort of a, I want a fruit tree, but it's got to be in the landscape. Well, there you go. You'll get more plums than you know what to do with, I guarantee. And it's a really nice focal point. So that's a case where you'd be using the growth habit as a landscape feature. And we're in the genus Prunus, and you get a lot of fruit out of it. So I don't know if fruit is a goal here. I would only plant a weeping Santa Rosa plum where you're prepared for 500 to 1,000 fruit on the ground in a typical summer harvest, early summer harvest, but it's the great Santa Rosa quality plum on a tree that's quite lovely in the landscape.
Well, the next thing in our mailbag is something that I sent in, and that's because I was cruising around the internet, as I frequently do, and I came across this guide to how to know when to plant what. And I started reading it and I went, wait a minute, what? Huh? And so I thought I would share with you. Now, it doesn't matter which flowers trigger your planting of which things. That's not the point. I'll read the first couple. Wait for apple trees to bloom before planting bush beans. When the apple blossoms fall, plant pole beans and cucumbers.
Hold on right there. Miana apple has been in bloom since late February. We talked about that earlier. So I
okay, should hold on. Late February. Got and it. Then it talks about when the lilacs are in full bloom and when the lily of the valley is in full flower. We don't have a lily. So, and the bottom one I love. When peonies blossom, it is safe to plant heat-loving melons such as cantaloupe. Well, all of these things are wonderful. And obviously someone made them who was familiar with gardening and wrote down the triggers and the remembrances for their particular area. Yeah. So you wouldn't have to remember times or dates or anything. It was just like, oh, the apple blossoms are blooming. I'll plant my bush beans. So my whole point in putting this out there is that this was made for a particular region, a particular area, and it's not mine. It's probably not yours either. I don't know where you live, but it could be.
Yeah, but, it could be. I don't know.
So we have so many people in so many places that one of these things is not going to be sufficient for everybody. So,
well, this would be a great Mad Libs. I can see how this would be a lot of fun to do regionally. For example, transfer tomato transplants to the garden when Lily of the Valley is in full flower. We don't actually grow Lily of the Valley here because it doesn't get cold enough for it to bloom. So that one wouldn't really work well for us. But they're probably, this is called phenology, not phrenology. Phenology is just the science, if you will, of using naturally occurring phenomena to guide your gardening practices, at least in our case. Phrenology was that thing where they
looked at the bumps on your head.
Checked the bumps on your head and determined what your personality was going to be or something like that. But these are all perfectly valid somewhere. And we have undoubtedly perfectly valid similar things here. The funny thing about these is they're always plants that are from colder USDA zones than here. Peonies are grown here. We sell them, we grow them. I can't honestly remember exactly which time of year they bloom. But yes, it's spring, late spring, so that's probably a safe time to plant heat-loving melons. But we got to have our own thing here. So wherever you are, remember that gardening is loco.
Local with an L on the end.
Gardening is local, and you probably have appropriate phenological markers in your area, and I'd be kind of curious what they are. I think I'm going to print this out and start marking up what would be blooming when we would be planting bush beans, because as mentioned earlier in the broadcast, I've had an apple variety blooming since late February, but most of them bloom in April. Okay, that would be a good time to plant bush beans, as long as you broadly state most apple varieties. We have a lot of different varieties that bloom at different times. So phenology is great, but it is very local. And it's actually a fascinating subject because that's where, in my opinion, old-time gardeners can be really, really helpful, is they can give you some marker like that. I've always had some great ones, like when the oak leaves are the size of a squirrel's ear, you do this, that, or the other. And I'm going, which
how many
kind of
people
oak
know
kind
what
of squirrel?
Squirrels? And we didn't have tree squirrels in here until recently,
right.
20 years ago.
Yeah, so phenology is local like gardening. There you go.
And then maybe loco too.
There's one of them that's been a good example for years, that you would apply a pre-emergent to your lawn to prevent crabgrass when the forsythias were blooming. This was actually on the label of pre-emergent herbicides because it's such a good guide. In that particular case, forsythias bloom when the soil temperature reaches a certain point. And soil temperature reaching that certain point is also the temperature at which crabgrass begins to germinate or is about to germinate a week or two or three later. So if you wanted to know when to put Dacthal on your lawn to prevent crabgrass when the forsythias were in full bloom, that was a good time to do it. There aren't that many forsythias in the Davis area. I sell maybe one or two a year, and mostly to nostalgic East Coast folks. They grow here just fine. And yes, it would be a good time to apply pre-emergent to your lawn. But these tend to assume a whole bunch of these things. I'm told that back east, forsythias are everywhere. And they're beautiful because they're a harbinger of spring. So you just have to adapt it to your region. How's that? Great find, Lois, because this really does show us one of the problems with gathering your gardening information from sources like the internet. In the old days, all right, I'm gonna sound old, we all used the Sunset Western Garden Book in California. We all looked at the same reference. We all acknowledge it as the master reference for our region. And in the East Coast, Bailey's Manual and some of the other, and down in the Southeast, various books by regional authors or regional collaborations such as the Western Garden Book. That's fallen by the wayside because it hasn't been updated in over a decade, and it will probably never be updated again. But when you worked in a nursery, when I started, you got your own copy of the Western Garden Book with your name on it, and you carried it around. You looked stuff up all the time, and we all had the same frame of reference. And it was very local, and you could go, oh, this zone, that zone here in California. Unfortunately, now you can get your advice from some guy in Saskatchewan who knows when the oak leaves are the size of squirrel ears.
So I got a message in the email recently from Arash saying, hello, Lois. It's always a pleasure listening to your show with Don on KDRT. I want to share you with my personal firsthand experience about a couple of observations that are different than what you may have had. This is about scrub jays. In the show on March 7th, scrub jays were characterized as non-birdivores. I found the term funny, actually. I made up that term. I actually wasn't referring to scrub jays at that time. I was talking about something else, but okay. Scrub jays are birdivores.
Yeah.
No, we'll keep reading his letter. However, I've witnessed firsthand how 5 years ago in North Davis, one of them blatantly ate the babies of starlings with the parents in front of the parents. Ew.
Yeah.
Parents were screaming and flying around in distress, and only after the last of the babies were eaten did the jay leave. It was heartbreaking. Same thing happened last year in front of my office window when a pair of robins had built a nest amongst the branches of my pluot tree. This time, this jay would wait until the parents were not in the nest before he would sneak in and eat chicks. All right. So,
that's horrible.
So let me answer that part. But no, it's
nature.
How shall I put it this way?
Life. It's the circle of life. I understand all that. Yeah.
Scrub jays will build a nest and have babies.
Yes.
And then as soon as those babies fledge and are out of there, they will have another batch of babies and another.
They have multiple generations.
Yes.
Oh, goodness.
And so the early ones usually make it through. The later ones, the last batch usually doesn't, because they don't have time to properly develop in that season, in that summer. But what happens is when the jays are doing that, they're using up so much energy that it's not sufficient for them to eat just seeds, which is what they usually eat. So they'll go after, you know, other things. You know that they'll go after bugs. They'll do that most any time, but they will also go and hunt babies.
Oh.
Yeah. And it's very sad, but you know, that's the way nature is. Now, hummingbirds, you think, oh, hummingbirds, they're cute. They're little.
Yeah, they're aggressive.
And they drink nectar, so that they can't be harmful to anything. Well, it turns out that when they have babies, you can't really take a drop of nectar and carry it back to the baby and feed it. It doesn't work. So they also get insectivores. They become insectivores, and they'll go hunting, you know, in little bugs, and they'll actually act like insect eaters, flying around going, "Ooh, there's a bug," flying out and grabbing it and then taking it back to the nest. They'll look, hunt for spiders. Yeah. Sometimes if you see one looking in your window, it probably isn't looking in the window. It's looking on the window to see if there are any little spiders or bugs or anything around the edges there that it can grab.
Well, that's nice of them. Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, and Arash continues, the other comment about hummingbirds and bird baths, I believe the comment was hummingbirds don't bathe. Well, I think that I must have been speaking poorly that day, because hummingbirds do bathe. Anyway, I have several hummingbirds who bathe in my bird bath every morning just after dawn. Oh, isn't that cool? Yeah. So yeah, hummingbirds don't go to the bird bath to drink is what I was trying to say. Not that they don't bathe, but it's that they get their fluid from the nectar that they sip, and they don't really need to go and find water to drink.
So at sunrise, you'll see them at your bird bath. Cool.
Not my bird bath.
Not your bird bath.
No, my bird bath isn't, it isn't very good for that small a bird. The edges are too straight down, and though it isn't deep, it's short enough that a junco can take a bath standing on its own feet.
So a hummingbird would like something that they can sit on the edge of the bird bath.
Either that, or it's so shallow that it's, you know, less than an eighth of an inch deep or something.
Yeah.
But
you know, I've always found on my own property that moving water certainly draws them when you've got a sprinkler.
Oh, yes.
All kinds of birds, by the way, love that. Something I learned years ago, I'll be walking out on the farm and I'll see a leak in the drip line. It's spraying some water. It's not an emergency to fix that. Mm-hmm. You want to get it fixed before it becomes a major flood, but all kinds of wildlife take advantage of it while it's running. So I give myself the excuse, well, that's good for the wildlife. I'll go do something else right now.
Well, you know, I actually set up at one of the spigots in our yard, I set up a drip intentionally. And I put below it just a very shallow dish. So it wasn't dropping into the soil. It was dropping into a little tiny saucer. And I was having those tiny little frogs, you know, those cute little frogs. Oh, it was really nice. So anyway, a little bit of water out there doesn't hurt anything.
Right, and make sure that it drains off to a plant that'll benefit from it. We learned that years ago when we were irrigating. We still had potholes in our driveway, and they would fill with water, and you would watch birds flock around them until the water disappeared in the middle of the driveway. So you had to be fairly careful. Having a little dripper going into a bird bath and letting it overflow to a nearby plant that would benefit from that, not something susceptible to Phytophthora, but grasses in particular, sedges, things like that. I often get people coming in who have a fountain, and they may be converting it to a planter or something, but it still overflows locally. There are plants that can take that kind of moisture that look really good right at the base of a fountain or a bird bath, acorus, things like that. Some of the sedges, some of the grasses, of course, are great for that. So having a natural vegetation underneath it that will absorb the extra water would be something that can make it actually a very attractive part of the landscape.
Okay, so we have had a couple of questions from people about whether or not you are going to get seeds, weed seeds, in your compost if you get compost. And I think that the concern is with the local compost, because here in Davis, we have a city-run, county-run procedure where they come by and they pick up our compostables from every house, and they put them in, and then they make compost out of them. And so, Don, what is it? Is it safe? Will you get weed seeds in there?
If the compost pile has been managed correctly, such as 131 degrees, according to the city website, then you should not have weed seeds. For anyone to call it compost in the state of California, including municipalities, it has to have been kept at that temperature for a fixed period of time, and they have to certify that to the state. Okay, so this is one of the reason I wanted to bring this up. You're not seeing very many bagged products in garden centers in California that have the word compost on them anymore, because in order to put compost as the label, we used to sell a product called planting compost. The manufacturer had it in piles out in the sun. They took front end loaders. They kept moving it, you know, piling it up, turning it just like you do on a smaller scale. But if they wanted to sell that as with compost as part of its label, they had to validate for each batch to the state that it had reached this internal temperature and been kept there for a certain period of time. The composting process in Yolo County generally reaches temperatures, they tell us, of 140 to 190 degrees throughout the aerobic composting phase, which lasts at least 2 weeks. So it's been piled up for many weeks. It has reached a verified, validated internal temperature high enough to prevent the spread of pathogens or weed seeds or even weed fragments. But if you want information, and there's a great website for this, it is yolocounty.org. You could probably just type in Yolo County compost and you'll find the FAQs there, how they make it, what's made from, how long they do it, and all that kind of stuff that we just talked about. So just head on over to yolocounty.org, the government website, and look for the information about their composting process. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.